What we're celebrating this evening is the 21st anniversary of the awarding at the New York Public Library of the Helen Bernstein Award for Excellence in Journalism, a $15,000 prize to the best book written by an American journalist in the past year. For the last 21 years, the Bernstein and Feeley families have demonstrated their commitment to the cause of sterling journalism through the support of this annual award. And before I introduce this evening's speaker, I'd like to ask you to join me in thanking Helen Bernstein Feeley and her children and family members who are here this evening for their continuing and very generous support of the work that we do here at the New York Public Library. I'd like to also thank the members of the Bernstein Award Selection Committee who have faced the difficult task of choosing among five extraordinarily accomplished works by five American journalists. And I would like to congratulate this year's winner, Charles Savage, who is right here. Congratulations, Charles. Charles is the author of Takeover, The Return of the Imperial Presidency and the Subversion of American Democracy. His book is all about power, and since Elaine Chiolino is our speaker this evening, his speaking about his book reminded me that when Nicolas Sarkozy and Ségolène Royal had their debate, the first debate that they had for the presidency of the French Republic, the first question asked of them was what were their respective definitions of power and how would they exercise it. So a certain kind of resonance with Charles's wonderful book, the kind of question that I wish would be asked by our president to our presidential candidates here in the United States. We also congratulate our other talented finalists, Jonathan Cohen, Naomi Klein, Robin Meredith, and Jeffrey Toobin. And now to the main event. Tonight's program is a very special conversation and talk, first talk and then some conversation, including you in the audience, with a most alluring title, Seduction à la Française, Politics, Society, and Discourse. Elaine F. Chiolino, a past Helen Bernstein Award winner and current member of the Bernstein Award Selection Committee, has kindly allowed to let us turn the tables for this evening. Instead of investigating other people and other cultures, as she so often does, Elaine has agreed to make some comments and to sit down with me and talk about her extraordinary experiences in Paris as the Paris bureau chief for the New York Times, a post that she held for 6 years, from 2002 through the beginning of this year, when she took on a position as foreign correspondent for the Times, covering the immensely important issue of terrorism. Elaine Chiolino has reported for the Times since 1984, and during this time she has covered a range of national and cultural issues, including the Middle East, the United Nations, the CIA, and the diplomatic corps. This insightful reporting on her part has led to two marvelous books. Her first was the prophetic The Outlaw State, Saddam Hussein's Quest for Power and the Gulf Crisis, and her second, equally far-sighted book, The Persian Mirrors, The Elusive Face of Iran, which won the Helen Bernstein Award for Excellence in Journalism here at the library in 2001. It is my privilege to serve as Elaine Chiolino's interviewer tonight, not simply because I admire her courageous and insightful work, but also because I myself am a lifelong student of France, although my field of inquiry, that of Voltaire and the philosophers of the Enlightenment, is at a remove of a couple of hundred years from Elaine's Parisian beat. It's at a remove chronologically, but the legacy of the Enlightenment is very much alive, not only in France, but also here in the United States. I'm delighted to have this opportunity to discuss the continuity that can be found in French culture and politics over the centuries, as well as to examine the striking transformations that are happening today in contemporary France, about which Elaine has written with such eloquence and so much power. At the conclusion of these more formal parts of our evening, the floor will be open for questions for members of the audience, and we will have microphones passed to you so that when you ask a question, everybody will be able to hear it. And now it is my great, great pleasure to introduce a marvelous friend of the library, an absolutely brilliant journalist, and a wonderful, wonderful friend, Elaine Chiolino.
Hello. Thank you so much, Paul. Paul is the expert on all things French, and he's promised to join and enrich my opening remarks with a conversation. So he's really going to bail me out if I get into trouble with all of you France lovers in the audience. I want to say congratulations first to our winner, Charlie Savage, who proved with this book that there is room in print journalism and in book writing to do serious, groundbreaking work that speaks truth to power. And he didn't do it by webcamming on an internet site. He did it the old-fashioned way, which is hard slogging, good classic journalism. So bravo. Thanks to the Bernstein family and to Helen Bernstein Feely for steadfastly supporting this award over the years. It means so much to all of us in journalism. And thanks to Karen Van Westering and Betsy Bradley for putting this program together. I love being back here because it feels like coming home. It was in the Wertheim study that every day I worked on a doctorate in 18th century French history that I never finished. And my two wonderful friends who slaved together for years, one of them, my one friend Elaine finished her doctorate, so bravo to you, we're here. It was the days where there was no air conditioning, and we used to come with like washcloths or towels to put under our legs so that we'd absorb the sweat in the summertime. I'm coming back someday to finish that doctorate, I just want you to know. Meanwhile, let's talk tonight a little bit about France. Nicolas Sarkozy, he's a power projector. He's sending more than 1,000 troops to Afghanistan. He's planning to build a military base in the United Arab Emirates. He's selling weapons to countries like Algeria and Libya. He has this ambitious dream to create a Mediterranean Union, and of course he'll be the head of it. He becomes president of the European Union for a six-month period starting in July, and he basically sees himself as Mr. Europe. And as he arrogantly said about France in an interview that I did with him last fall, if France doesn't take the lead, who will? So it's in this context that I want to tell you about a new book that I picked up as I was flying over here, written by a 34-year-old foreign ministry speechwriter. It's not a tome about France's new projection of power under Sarkozy, but it deals with a subject that's just as important. It's a guide to finding the prettiest women in Paris. As Pierre Collin, Louis Collin writes, the greatest marvels of Paris are not in the Louvre. They are in the streets and in the gardens, in the cafes and in the boutiques. The greatest marvels of Paris are the hundreds of thousands of women whose smiles, whose cleavages, whose legs bring incessant happiness to those who take promenades. You just have to know where to contemplate them. Collin even offers a chart, because this is France, everything has to have charts and is encadré. And he even offers a chart that tells you where to go when. You go to the Champs-Élysées on Mondays between 10 and 2. You go to the Faubourg Saint-Honoré on Wednesdays between 2 and 6. And the Canal Saint-Martin on Sundays between 6 and 10 in the evening. The book is patently sexist. It's filled with tips on how to observe au pairs and young mothers without them noticing, and how to go out in rainstorms so that you can catch women in wet, clingy clothing. It could obviously never have been published here in the United States. But the fact that a perfectly serious foreign policy advisor could have so much fun writing a perfectly politically incorrect book tells you something about setting priorities in France. And since we're in a library and among all you book people, it may also tell you something about the book publishing industry in France these days. You see, flirtation and seduction are embedded in French life, and you're lost until you understand the rules of the game. I mean, France, after all, is a place where the government just supported a 600-page sociological study on sexuality. Among its conclusions, French women are becoming increasingly assertive in their sexual habits. Women now have more than twice as many partners in the 1970s, and for those of you who, like me, are over 50, 9 out of 10 women over 50 are sexually active. Seduction is part of politics, and certainly power attracts. When Edgar Garfour became president's prime minister in the 1950s, he gained the lofty title of president of the council. And that apparently made all the difference. He was quoted as saying, When I was a minister, some women resisted me. Once I became president, not even one. So to understand France, you have to understand that a fundamental rule of French politics is that good politicians love and are loved. This is a quote from Valéry Giscard d'Estaing on TV a couple years ago. When I was president of the Republic, I was in love with 17 million French women. When I saw them in the crowd, they felt it, and then they voted for me. So this is a primary night. I'm sorry I couldn't get this advice to the candidates before tonight, but it's key. Jacques Chirac had such power over women that his wife Bernadette confessed in a book in 2001 that she suffered from terrible jealousy. The day Napoleon abandoned Josephine, he lost everything. She warned him several times. There was also a book published in 2006. It was called Sexus Politicus, by two very serious investigative journalists. In fact, one of them's expertise is on terrorism. And it speculated that one of the reasons that Lionel Jospin just couldn't make it as a presidential candidate is that he was lacking in seduction. I mean, Ségolène Royal, by contrast, looks absolutely fabulous in a bikini. She was on the cover of a couple magazines in this turquoise blue bikini. And, you know, as someone who had four kids and was in her 50s, she looked pretty good. But she also came across as kind of a hectoring, nagging wife, and the French just don't go for that kind of thing. As presidents go, I have to tell you from personal experience that Giscard d'Estaing is very good at flirting, and even at his age. And Jacques Chirac is very good at charming, even at his age. The first time I interviewed Chirac was in 2002 at the height of America's bashing of France for its unwillingness to embrace the war in Iraq. Chirac cradled my hand as if it were one of his pieces of fine Chinese porcelain. He took me onto the terrace of the Élysée and showed me around and offered to have my daughters come back one day. I mean, I thought he was going to offer me the Légion d'honneur, or at least French citizenship. It was so gushy. The last time I interviewed him, he veered off topic and said that it would not be all that dangerous for Iran to have one or two nuclear weapons. He said if Iran ever did such a thing, and if it ever tried to use a bomb against, say, Israel, Israel would basically destroy Tehran. Well, that certainly wasn't French policy. And later in the day, when the 19-page official transcript of the interview came to my office, it didn't include that little bit. It was not there. In fact, in even more creative diplomacy, it added a line that Chirac never said. He imagined that he had said, "I do not see what type of scenario could justify Iran's recourse to an atomic bomb." And when I told his handlers that I was going to publish his real interview, I was invited back to the Élysée Palace the next day for a lesson in intellectual seduction. It was after lunch, and I could smell wine on Chirac's breath as he kissed my hand, of course, and went into charm overdrive. He explained that he thought he was off the record, and I pointed out, excuse me, Mr. President, but he never said the words, the magic three words, off the record. I have to say he did the right thing. He said, "Dear Madam, it was I who was wrong. I don't want to question that. I should rather have paid attention to what I was saying and understood that perhaps I was off the record." He kissed my hand again and asked me to come back anytime. Afterwards, his aides asked me, "Well, did the president convince you not to write what he said on Iran?" And I said, "No, I'm an American, and you know, seduction only goes so far with us Americans, you know." We're in a weird moment in France these days because Nicolas Sarkozy hasn't mastered the art of either political or personal seduction. On the contrary, he is so angry and so brittle that he has a hard time even getting people to work for him. Even his chief of protocol is said to be too afraid of him to interrupt him. I mean, Sarko was supposed to be at a at a NATO head of state meeting, and he didn't show up, and nobody was brave enough to go in and tell the president, "You got to get into the meeting, sir." He is so anti-Turkey and anti-Muslim in private that one of his aides even told me that even the Swedes are upset. The first time I interviewed Sarkozy, it was just after he was elected. It was just on the eve of the G8 summit, and Bush had done his G8 preview interview. Putin had done his pre-G8 interview. So Sarkozy invited in the representatives from each of the seven other G8 countries, and I was in the American seat. The first thing he did is he ordered all of us to turn off our tape recorders, just point off, 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 off. And he said to us, "I was interior minister, so I know the importance of this kind of maneuver to use your tape recorders." The problem was that the Elysee Palace didn't have its own recording device, so there is no permanent record anywhere of President Sarkozy's first interview with the foreign press. He also doesn't have very good manners, which isn't very good if you want to seduce. We were in the Napoleon Trois room. It's this fabulous room next to his office. And while he was talking, he was eating bits of cheese and charcuterie. And he never asked us to break bread with him. And you know, as the daughter of an Italian-American food merchant, you know that the first thing you do is you feed your guests. My second interview with him was even more challenging. He walked into the room, and he seemed to be limping. He greeted us with a stiff handshake. There was no hand kissing, and a very curt bonjour. And even when I presented him with New York Times baseball caps for him and his son, he didn't react, which I thought, you know, I thought at least he would like our little baseball hats. He interrupted us, even insulted us. I was with a female colleague from the International Herald Tribune throughout our hour-long encounter. It took Leslie Stahl of 60 Minutes to get his bad mood on camera. He walked off the set after he was asked an embarrassing question about his then-failing marriage, and the French could forgive him for that. But what shocked everybody is that he called his press spokesman. This was his right-hand man, the guy who postponed his wedding because Sarkozy wanted him to be on call that weekend. He called him an imbecile. Now, that's perhaps inexcusable behind closed doors, but not on American television. The French people now consider Sarkozy the worst president in the history of the entire Fifth Republic. According to recent polls, de Gaulle gets the highest marks with about 88% approval rating, and Sarkozy's varies between 28 and 35%. He's in such disfavor for failing to make the magic he promised that there's even a phenomenon in France today called Sarkophobia. It's all the more disappointing because he ran a disciplined and brilliant presidential campaign. It had nothing to do with seduction. It had to do with promises. And the main reason for his fall from grace is his failure to deliver more buying power to the French. This past year has seen 20% increase in energy costs, 6% increase in food costs, at the time when pay increases have been below 1% for nearly a decade. Libération, since this is France, Libération, the sort of left-leaning daily newspaper, ran an article a couple months ago about the high price of bread and covered its front page with a photograph of a baguette. People only have to work 35 hours a week in France, and they get, as those of you who know France well, get more than twice the paid vacation that most of us get. But now they're almost too poor to go on vacation, so there's a big boom in kind of family home renovation businesses. His mantra is work more to earn more, but the French want none of it. Yesterday was the 10th anniversary of the decision by the socialist government to shorten the work week for 39 to 35 hours at no loss of pay. And perhaps to mark it, the head of Sarkozy's what the party that Sarkozy used to head called for a definitive end to the 35-hour work week. But within hours, he was slapped down and contradicted by the president. But there's an exception here to Sarkozy's bad performance in his first year as president. He succeeded in seducing America. And this, in a sense, is surprising because his opposition to the Iraq War has been just as fierce as that of Jacques Chirac. I want to revisit that period in 2002-2003, which was the lowest point in Franco-American relations in decades, when from the American, in the American view, France abandoned its oldest ally in the world when the chips were down and tried to persuade others to do the same. In the French view, it was just that France didn't believe in the game, so it gathered up its own chips and walked away from the table. In researching this, my talk tonight, I found a story I once wrote about a meeting between Chirac and Bush shortly after the invasion of Iraq, and I thought I'd quote a few lines from it to indicate that I didn't, you know, in retrospect, maybe the French weren't all that wrong. Chirac said that he knew from bitter experience not to underestimate the power of Arab nationalism, and that a swift transfer of sovereignty from the Americans to the Iraqis was crucial. Otherwise, Chirac said, you will trigger more and more frustrations, resentment, and a kind of resistance. Bush replied, Jacques, I have listened carefully, and I totally disagree with your analysis, adding that the Iraqi resistance to the United States consisted only of the remnants of Saddam Hussein's followers and the supporters of Osama bin Laden. Chirac appeared to back off, saying he was making his point as a friend and an ally, and then he added, history will judge. Sarkozy's just as pointed when it comes to Iraq. It's not France's business to go to Iraq in any shape or form, he said when I interviewed him last fall. But both the Bush administration and the Congress have given him a pass on Iraq. Sarko l'Américain, as he is called, is considered the most pro-American French president in decades. He's the son of a Hungarian immigrant father, a French-Greek mother whose father was Jewish, and he unabashedly confesses his admiration for the United States. He's tough on Iran. In fact, France has an even more pessimistic analysis of Iran's ability to eventually make a nuclear weapon. He calls himself a friend of Israel. He wants a strong NATO, and he's committed to reversing a four-decade policy and restoring France to NATO's military wing. He's even seduced the American Congress. I mean, even I was moved when I saw a three-minute standing ovation in the American Congress when he appeared before a joint session last year. Mitch McConnell of Kentucky, the Republican leader, after Sarkozy's speech said, you just heard a Ronald Reagan speech from a president of France. It was almost an out-of-body experience for all of us. What's amusing is that the speech happened almost by chance. The initial speech was much tougher. There was this horrible criticism of Guantanamo in it and criticism of the Bush administration's failure to take the environment seriously. But Sarkozy's national security advisor got a hold of the speech and cut out all the stuff. And by the time the speechwriter made it to Washington on a later plane, the speech was already at the printer. So a little bit of guerrilla diplomacy here. But I know what you're all thinking. Well, wait a second. Sarkozy wooed and seduced and married a gorgeous, super rich Italian model turned pop singer. Again, we have to go back a bit. Let's not forget that Sarkozy's wife, Cecilia, walked out on him, came back, and then dumped him for good. And as president of France, he couldn't bear to be seen lacking in sex appeal. So after she left him the first time, he at first presented himself as kind of lonely and deserving of pity. But that seemed very un-French. So he let it known through his friends that his love life was just fine. And he was quoted as saying through a friend, if I have a free evening, I know who I want to spend it with. And since French journalism is so different from American journalism, the woman who was then the woman of his life was the woman who was covering the Élysée for Le Figaro, a major French newspaper. Okay, so Carla. Well, it turns out she was the seductress. They met at a small dinner, and after dessert, she asked him if he had a car waiting outside. And Sarkozy said he did, and he offered to escort her home. And she invited him up for coffee, and he said, never on a first date. The exceptionally tolerant French were not at all perturbed that Mr. Sarkozy's 11-year marriage ended in divorce. But, I mean, after all, during the campaign, there was one poll that found that most French voters wanted their next president to be around 50 years old, multilingual, honest, and willing to listen. Only 17% said they would not vote for someone who had extramarital affairs. But there's a saying that still prevails in France: to live happy, live hidden. And Sarkozy had to learn the hard way that his citizenry doesn't appreciate his flamboyant Rolex Ray-Ban chartered plane style. The tabloid photos of Sarkozy and Carla lack taste. I mean, this is a woman who once called monogamy terribly boring and called herself a tamer of men. She called herself faithful to herself. And she seemed to like power, this is one of the things that attracted her, I assume, to Sarkozy, because she was once quoted as saying, I want a man with nuclear power. But now she's reinvented herself as the model first lady. Sure, there were the photos of Carla posing in thigh-length leather boots and nothing else for a Spanish magazine, and the photo of a frontal naked Carla with one hand over her privates that was put up for sale at auction. Now she's turned herself into the model first lady and wife, and there are photos of Carla curtsying to the Queen of England. She spent a lot of time on that curtsy with the wife of the British ambassador to France. She even wore a pillbox cap and carries one of those Queen of England-like pocketbooks. Remember the ones that Margaret Thatcher used to throw around? There's even more than a bit of revisionist history at the Élysée. So I brought a couple of covers of Perry Match to show you how it's been great for French journalism. Here's Carla. Her discreet charm has seduced South Africa. Then there's Carla, Queen of London. And now this is what makes the Élysée a little bit like the old Kremlin. Nicolas Sarkozy, a year at the Élysée, and there's Carla in this very virginal white shirt. Nobody mentions that they only got married in February. Sarkozy himself has vowed to do better as president now that he's into his second year. Only last month he told a magazine interviewer, I am not giving a rosy picture of it, but after all, running a country is not as hard as I thought. But when he marked the one-year anniversary of the presidency with a 90-minute interview, he used the word mistake 5 times, and the French media immediately took note of his new humility. Ah, France. Before I finally give up my perch, and Paul has been very patient listening to my stories, and I want him to do the critique, I want to salute all of our authors and reveal to them and to our audiences that every one of the 5 books is really about France. Now I'm going to explain why. You may think this is far-fetched, but Charlie Savage wrote about the Imperial United States, and one could make a case that George Bush and Dick Cheney just learned their strategies from Napoleon. Jeffrey Toobin wrote about Justice Kennedy's intellectual transformation from his trips to Europe, including France. And as someone who had once had to translate for Justice Kennedy and a member of the Constitutional Court at a dinner party, I can tell you that he tries really hard in French. He really does okay. Robin Meredith offers us the fascinating detail that 16 of the world's most polluted cities are in China, which I would say is an endorsement for keeping the French countryside picture perfect and granting it UNESCO landmark status. Jonathan Cohn's Sick about the healthcare crisis in America reminds us that one of the reasons that the French economy is not doing better is that social services, including generous healthcare benefits, cost so much in America. they're so generous that once I turned up at an emergency room with the son of a sick the sick child of a friend who was visiting in Paris, and it was a Sunday, and they didn't know how to do the billing, so they just gave us the emergency care for free. Naomi Klein's expose of the dark side of globalization, well, it could have been written by a Frenchman, and I'm sure the book will be a sensation when it's translated into French, which proves that the 19th century poet and playwright Henri de Bournier was right when he wrote, "Every man has two countries, his own and France." So bravo to our authors, and thank you all so much for hearing me out on a country that has infuriated, inspired, and amused, but has never bored me. Vive la Bibliothèque Publique de New York, et vive la France. Merci. And thank this man for giving me this much time. Over to you.
Thank you, Leigh. If we can just stay with the issue of power for a moment, because that's Charlie's issue relative to what's happened in the United States over the course of the past year. And if you haven't read the book, you must read it, because it's really an extraordinarily comprehensive, if not, and chilling, analysis of a rebirth of the imperial presidency in the United States. But from the things that I've read by you, in particular, and some others as well, I guess, the same kind of sort of accumulation of power is taking place in the Élysée Palace in ways that the French are completely unused to, because the President of the Republic is now surrounded less by his ministers, his people of influence, than by the sort of inner circle of enormously influential people. The former French ambassador to the United States is now the senior foreign policy advisor rather than the Minister of Foreign Affairs. So can you talk a little bit about that and some of the implications of that? Is there a kind of new level of the imperial presidency in France, as Charlie argues that there is in the United States?
Well, this, can you hear all of us? This is a great point, and I'd welcome your thoughts on this, because he has transformed the whole structure of the French government. He's president, prime minister, and foreign minister. And when he wants to, he's minister of education. Like when he said that every French school child should align himself or herself with a child victim of the Holocaust and learn that child's history, which is could be done in America, but it's not at all very French. I mean, wouldn't you say?
I would say so, absolutely. And he got roasted for that. But when they talk about Socol Américain, aren't they also, in addition to the aviator glasses and the Rolex and some of the other trappings, they're also thinking about him being seen in jogging shorts or in blue jeans or on a horse. And then an early date at Euro Disney outside
right.
of Paris. So there's part of a whole package, is there not, that he structured, I think, deliberately for himself to project a different kind of presidency for France than the aloof, kind of standoffish predecessors or pose of the predecessors that he had. But your argument is that he's run counter to the main sort of determinant in French politics, if not in French life, and that is that the act of seduction has to be a very consciously played role, and it's an expected role. And then if you don't play that role, then the equation is somehow reversed, the paradigm is shifted or broken, with all kinds of really serious consequences in terms of your standing in public opinion polls. No.
Well, Chirac, Giscard, they loved being with the people. I mean, Chirac loved to seduce women, but he also loved to seduce the French. And I cannot ever remember being a time with Chirac when he didn't want to go out and hug the people.
Clintonian, in that way.
Very Clintonian. And, you know, if I had to spend an evening with either Chirac or Sarkozy, even though Chirac's, you know, much older, I'd much rather spend it with Chirac. You know, Sarkozy doesn't have this kind of natural kind of love of the people. And he was caught when he was at the agricultural fair where, you know, some guy in the, you know, started yelling, you know, oh, you know, you were just a, nasty old whatever. It was a kind of an expletive. And Sarkozy, you know, instead of just saying, oh, you know, have a good day, engages, reduces himself to that level, and uses an expletive back.
It's on YouTube.
It's on YouTube. Yeah, it's on YouTube.
Well, it's curious today that one of the sort of landmarks works of French literature having to do with seduction, Les Liaisons Dangereuses, is a big hit on Broadway. And as I thought about Elaine's topic, it occurred to me that if you look at French literature, which I sort of know more about than French politics, the whole sort of central position that seduction takes in French literature is one that goes back to the late Middle Ages with the Romance of the Rose and goes throughout, but with a major role being played in the 18th century when that novel was such a scandalous hit. And now you can see it on Broadway, so it's a reminder of that very central fact of cultural life and social life in France. One of the things that I found in extraordinarily sort of arresting about Elaine's coverage of French affairs over the last 6 years is that she could write authoritatively about French politics through these unbelievable interviews with the French heads of state and the other major players within the French political sphere. But then at the same time, she could write charming pieces about how radically different the French are from us in cultural terms. The most significant of those being her sort of au revoir, her goodbye piece that I hope you all saw in the News of the Week in Review, that talked about, really, in all these different categories, how substantially different the French are from us. For example, the percentage of a woman's clothing budget that she spends on lingerie, 20% was it? So, I mean, I never knew that. And that you must, if you're having a hamburger or a pizza or a sandwich in France, you're supposed to be eating it with a knife and fork. I mean, wonderful, wonderful telling points about the distinctive nature of that culture and those people and how different it is from us. But then there's something else that she covered with an enormous amount of power. And I remember when we sat next to each other at one of the Bernstein Awards just before you went to Paris, and you said, you said to me, you know, what should I be paying attention to? What's sort of important there? And my answer, I believe, was racial issues, especially the situation of North Africans. And not that I was in any way prophetic, but it always seemed to me that when you compared France and the position that people of color, especially North Africans, occupied in that society as opposed to the gains that have been made, obviously through massive civil rights movements and so on and so forth in the United States, that there was a radical, radical difference. Very, very rarely were people of African origin, including people of North African, that is Arab origin, former Algerians, and so on and so forth, very rarely, if ever, did they find themselves in any kind of an elected office in France, certainly at the national level. And if you look at the diversity and the representation of people of color in our society as opposed to that in France, France looks, I don't know, 50 years behind us. And then not so long after you got there, things sort of blowing up in a very literal kind of sense. So if you had to sort of give us your insights today as to what the prospects are, and Sarkozy, you know, made some comments about the people who were rioting that were themselves explosive. But if you had to forecast the extent to which the French will really ever be able to do anything of consequence and of significance in this vast problem that they have in the suburbs, is there anything positive that you foresee happening? There are all kinds of promises always made by the heads of state, but do you really see any results coming out of anything?
Well, your comments strike me on a number of different levels. I mean, first of all, Sarkozy hasn't done too badly in terms of the composition of his cabinet.
That's quite
he's
true.
Got the justice minister is of Arab origin, you know, and a woman, and one of his sub ministers in foreign affairs is black. I mean, this is and a woman. I mean, he's got another sub minister who used to be the head of an organization called Ni Putin Ni Soumise, neither whores nor doormats, basically. And she's a leftist, and she's been put in. So it's a real mixed cabinet. And that in and of itself, I mean, images matter. And to see these women with him every time he travels is very, very important, and it sends a very important signal. But I mean, I would welcome your views on this because you're much more of an expert than I. I mean, French republicanism dictates that you do not define people according to religion or race or ethnicity. You don't go to a dinner party and say, you know, I'm Jewish. You just right. it's just unheard of to have people talk about their religious or cultural or color identity. I think the problem of the suburbs is really fixable, and in many ways, I regret that I couldn't write more, because the first time I went to the suburbs, they're not like our slums. I mean, with very few exceptions, most of them are okay. You can walk there at least some of the hours of the day. I mean, there are some places where the police never go. But my first exposure to the suburbs was that I had a 12-year-old daughter who was a soccer player, and there was no team at her school, so she joined a French team, and she was 14 to 16-year-old player. And soccer is a lower class, working class sport in France. So, you know, middle class girls in Paris were not playing soccer. We had to go to the suburbs every weekend so she could play soccer. And you know, you're hanging out at the field with the fathers of you know, with the taxi drivers and the concierge and talking about what's going on in the field. These are working class people who are trying to make a better lives for themselves. There's not the incredible numbers of slums that we've got in America. And if there were more money and there was a recognition that there are people who are different from the ones who can go to the Grande École, who are Franco-Français, that could be the first step towards just saying, okay, how do we take these families with their kids out on the soccer field on Saturday mornings and make sure they get a good education and they have a chance to get a job?
The issue, though, is hopelessness, isn't it? That's what I read anyway, within young people within the suburbs.
Because the system doesn't allow the same sort of upward mobility that you can have in America.
Yeah. So would you predict more riots in the future?
Yeah. And the last spate of them, you saw for the first time the use of guns, but it was interesting because there aren't handguns the way there are in the United States, so they were basically hunting guns.
Right. Yeah. Sort of sinister. Let's switch to libraries for a minute, because something very interesting happened in France not so long ago, and I'd like to see what your take is on it. You know about this exhibit. It wasn't really covered in the United States. There is a very famous collection at the French National Library, which is sort of a sister institution to the New York Public Library. We're both about the same size in terms of our collections. And it's called the Hell Collection. And it came into being in the 1830s, and it became what we call a shelf mark or a classification. And it was applied to all books that were considered dangerous to morals, including especially erotica. So the Marquis de Sade's works would be there. And everything that was considered sort of dangerous to sort of the welfare of the people were put there. And as a reader at the library for many, many years, I always heard about it. It was sort of legendary, but no one I knew, none of the other readers I knew, had ever really taken out anything from the Enfer collection. And then the outgoing president of the National Library a couple of years ago made a decision to have an exhibit, a big exhibit in the major exhibit hall, of materials from this collection. And the French National Railway was the corporate sponsor. And they, you know, there were these four great big glass towers, and they had one of them with a huge red X on it, and they bathed the subway stop in sort of red light.
Bright pink.
I only saw photographs of it. Yeah. And they published a catalog. Nobody under 16 was allowed into the show. Now, we have huge erotica collections here at the New York Public Library. So can you imagine Amtrak sponsoring you know, a gigantic collection of erotica, very in-your-face kind of stuff from the collections of the New York Public Library. It was a huge success, I think, in France.
Well, I wrote a story about it, and that's I have to tell you why I went to see it, because my old, my, you know, you probably think that I spend my weekends taking my kids to, you know, art exhibits. My kids, I'm sorry, I got Annalyn Swan and Mark Stevens here, who are the most cultured people I know. They don't like art galleries. But I convinced my older daughter to go to the erotica show with me. I said, I'm going to take you to a show that you are not going to believe. And we had the most fun looking at all these, excuse me, penises, you know. And it was a fabulous show, but it was also very strange to be in a public library and looking at sort of 50, 60, 70-year-old films, pornographic films. You could never do a show like that in America. You couldn't. Congress would shut you down.
That's right.
Yeah.
Everybody would shut us down, I think. Everybody would shut us down. So does that have anything to do with seduction?
Yes, it's Bruno Racine, the head of the Bibliothèque Nationale, trying to seduce the French public to come into to look at a public library in a different way.
I think there is this notion of relevance that many people in the world of libraries are trying to prove that they are today, and that you think that was perhaps part of the plan.
Yeah. Oh, no question, because it was the most popular show that the library right. has
And they
done.
Extended it. Some,
That's right.
Some point.
That's right.
All right, well, we've had a wonderful conversation on this side, but let's have a conversation with you in the audience. So there are microphones, so gentlemen here, if you just wait a couple moments till it comes down. Gentleman in the striped shirt. Thank you, Betsy.
I'm late in life a Francophile. However, I became so suffused with interest that I lived in France for a couple of years. And I embraced with gusto the sophistication, the politesse, the charm, the je ne sais quoi, the style. And seeing the French people elect a Cézanne, a renegade, a vulgar, horrible person like Sarko makes me enraged. I don't let me back in the country. I'll insult all my dinner guests. I'll say, no, we don't have cowboys in America. We are not vulgar. You, I will be so upset. Now, my question is, do not the French people feel a measure of deep, profound disappointment over the crashing and fracturing of their image and their pedigree in the minds of people, almost like Baccarat crystal crashed on the floor of the Quai d'Orsay? That's my question.
Well, it's interesting. You used two important words, vulgar and disappointment. Vulgar is the word that is used to describe what's happened to the Élysée. And disappointment is something that you just have to look at the polls to see, and it's not just, you know, upper middle class people in the seventh arrondissement off the Rue du Bac. It's the taxi driver. It's the concierge. It's the mother of your friends. It's everyone feeling that there is just something a little bit déclassé about the style in the Élysée Palace, But, look, he's a year in, he said he's learned, and he's very smart. He's also, you know, he ran a very disciplined campaign. It was a brilliant campaign. And so one can say, well, you know, Sarko's first year wasn't too much worse than Chirac's first year of his 12-year presidency. So I probably was a little bit harsh because he didn't offer me anything to eat the first time I interviewed him. So we'll let him. We'll see what year. Invite me back in another year, and we'll see how he's done after year two.
We'll do that.
You see, what I want to say is I am French.
Oh, please. We need your voice.
Madam, here's the microphone.
I don't think he's vulgar. I think he's just an ordinary man. He is terribly ordinary. And, of course, the French, they think that their president, they expect their president to be extraordinary, especially if they voted for him. He is just ordinary. He will probably remain ordinary. But we do hope, I do hope, he will make something extraordinary, that is, to lead the reforms that we need. And that, with the population that he has to reform, that will be an extraordinary deed of that man. Sometimes ordinary people do extraordinary things.
Madam, I hope he makes you his chief of protocol, because he needs you. We need to add you to his cabinet.
There is that other issue that he is the first French president who has no feel or flair or authentic interest in literature. Virtually every other one was a writer. Georges Pompidou knew, I think, 50,000 verses of French poetry by heart. That's held against him as well, isn't it?
You know, that bothers me less. I mean, I was once at a state dinner where Bill Clinton, you know, we're all drinking champagne out of these elegant flutes, and he asked the Marine guard to get him a Coke and keep it in the a Diet Coke and keep it in the can. You know, our presidents don't have to be literary, but they have to care for their people, and that's what I want him to do. I want him to love the French people more.
True, but with culture being, you know, such an important part of French life and pride in culture, I do think that his apparent lack of appreciation of high culture is something that they hold against him. At least I read it. I probably read it in one of your columns. Yes?
So I have two questions. One does concern the president, which is, so he's the first president, is he not, of the Fifth Republic, who has not gone to one of the Grandes Écoles. And so the question is are the French... Is it not true, ma'am? Yeah. Shaking her head? Yeah. Are the French, you know, they so favor graduates from those schools in all leadership positions in their society. Is it true that they're looking at his presidency, at least so far, and thinking, well, maybe they should revert to that, go back to that earlier form? The second question has not to do with the president, but with the mayor of Paris and the transformations of Paris in the last decade, which seemed just totally remarkable. And I'd like to, if you would, to comment on the leadership style of the mayor of Paris and how that has resulted in massive transformation and yet at the same time enormous acceptance.
You know, sometimes I speak with great humility, and I really can't speak about what all the French people think about, you know, whether he should have gone to one of the Grandes Écoles. But I can say that I think that the biggest disappointment is the economy. And the biggest disappointment is that this president, who ran on a campaign, on a platform of change, and I'm going to make your life better, hasn't done that yet. You know, his first press conference that he did with the entire media, he said, the coffers are empty. That's not what the French wanted to hear. They wanted to hear, how are you going to make our lives better without us having to sacrifice the privileges we already have? You know, our incredible healthcare system, our 35-hour week, you know, all of our family benefits. And there are some things out of his control. He can't control the streets. He can't force through changes because there is just such an incredible fear that people are going to go to the streets, they're going to demonstrate, and you're going to paralyze the country. So I'd have to say that that's probably the most important reason why there's been disappointment. Not that he didn't go to a Grandes Écoles, or not that he, as Madame says, is ordinary. The second thing about the mayor of Paris, who's a socialist, he has done an incredible job. He's had enough money to light the city of Paris in a remarkable way, and we've talked about that because now the public library is going to be involved in a very interesting lighting project. If you go to Paris these days, you've got this bicycle system where you just, you know, take the bicycle and deliver it to another place. I mean, Paris itself is just even more of a jewel than before. It's easy to get around. The metros are clean. They work, not like the tube in London. The exhibits that City Hall does are remarkable. They're also free. The city museums are free. So, and he may end up in a real leadership position in the Socialist Party. So he's bravo to chapeau to him.
Hi, I'm wondering about the cabinet a little bit more. You said that he did a fairly good job of selecting cabinet members, very diverse backgrounds and so on and so forth. But I'm wondering how effective each of those cabinet members are, especially some of them who have been sort of plucked out from very obscure positions beforehand, and also his ability of getting rid of members of the Socialist Party by placing them in different areas, sending Dominique Strauss-Kahn to the World Bank, I think. So is that really a good thing for the French presidency and for France in the long run?
I think he's got a pretty good cabinet. The fact that he made Bernard Kouchner a leading socialist, his foreign minister, was a stroke of genius. The Fillon as prime minister, it's fascinating. He's really supposed to be the head of government and run the government day to day. Doesn't have the power to do so, but it's fascinating because he's much higher in the opinion polls than Sarkozy is. I mean, I don't think the problem is the composition of his cabinet. I think he's got really a very, very good cabinet. His challenge is to be able to let his cabinet do the job and to not try to do everything himself. And hopefully he'll be so involved with his new wife that he will let everybody in the cabinet do his or her job.
Great.
I'm being a bit, I really apologize if I'm being too iconoclastic, especially to our French guests. I truly love France.
Well, it is interesting that the presidents of both the United States and France at this point are polling sort of at historically low levels, I think. Sarkozy may have the lowest in the Fifth Republic, and I think our present president is polling at the same level that Harry Truman was at his nadir. We're about to have a change. It'll be interesting to see if year two for Sarkozy is better. And I mean, I think one has to realize that France, like the United States and virtually every other country, is being buffeted by economic forces and factors that are beyond the control of an individual head of state to really compensate for. Globalization and all the increase in energy costs and all the rest of it. So he's in a pickle, I think. And he seems to be super smart. You've met him, I never have. It'll be interesting to see if he can find a way out of this for himself and for his country. And it was also fascinating, I think, the reversal that he did on the 35-hour work week, which was reported in this morning's New York Times, which was the main plank in his platform, that was simply a scheme that didn't work. Now, one always has to remember that French workers on a per-hour basis are significantly more productive than their American counterparts are. The French economy is the fourth or fifth strongest in the world. And if you look at French technology in terms of trains and airports and a whole lot of other stuff, extraordinarily talented people in the private sector are creating amenities for the public good that are certainly in terms of public transportation and the rails 20 to 30 years in advance of what we have in this country. It's a very, very different, you do feel in many ways in a first world country when you're in France as opposed to the comparable kinds of services in the public sector in the United States. So it's an immensely strong country with extraordinarily important cultural heritage behind it. Figuring out its place in the New World Order has been a problem ever since the decline of the French Empire. Same for the UK, but when you think about several hundred thousand young French people living in the UK as opposed to in France because of the openness of that economy, that's a very significant issue, I think, for anyone in charge of politics in France. Well, this has been a wonderful evening for us at the library. Some of us could talk about these kinds of things until midnight, but it is already 8:10. Thank you very much, Elaine, for being with us.
Thank you.